Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. Now, a quick reminder before we get into the podcast is that nothing in this podcast should be taken on as personal financial advice. If you're ever unsure about your finances or investing, make sure you reach out to a qualified financial advisor. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, everyone, welcome back to the Young Investors Podcast. Hamish Hodder, how are you?
I am wonderful. I don't think you're too well, though. I think you're a little bit sick, right?
I am a bit. Usually it's Hamish that gets hit with the sickness, but I'm feeling pretty good. Like, I don't actually feel that bad. I'm just sick. It's just runny nose, blocked up. It's just not the best. But I actually feel good. So my voice is probably going to fail horrifically in this podcast, but I'm feeling good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I was going to say you've been cursed with the classic airport sickness that I think is just inevitable at this point. It feels like you just go through an airport and you're guaranteed to pick up some kind of virus or infection or something.
Yeah. So, I was doing so well. Like, all of Japan, I was being really careful, you know, lots of hand washing, not touching too much, you know, all that sort of stuff. Don't touch your face, all that stuff they tell you to do. When I went to Bali, of course, you got to be careful, like, with the water. Try and drink bottled water. I was doing so well. And then I got on the plane home. I was like, what the heck? And then sure enough, I landed back in Australia and just last few days, it's not been great. But that's okay. We're back in.
We are.
We got some interesting stuff to talk about. We've had a bit of time off from the podcast because I have been away.
Yeah.
So we got some stuff to talk about today. What on earth has been going on with Bitcoin, Hamish Hodder? Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Hamish is going to be talking about that today. I'm also going to, well, we're both going to talk about Warren Buffett's shareholder letter. Warren Buffett is back in the news, everybody, so we can rejoice. And then we've also got another couple of things, a little bit of, you guys like this segment, the old Hamish's fraud story of the week. So we've got one of those for today, and also we'll talk about Novo Nordisk a little bit as well. Yeah. But with that said,
today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. View buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings, and manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days. And as always, thanks to those who have signed up to Seeking Alpha using our link and are supporting the podcast. Do you want to? I think we should start with the shareholder letters, with the shareholder letter. I think. I honestly haven't read this yet.
Naughty boy!
I don't exactly know. This must have come out earlier this week, I'm guessing, or is it over the weekend? I guess, right? I think.
It came out when I was on a plane, maybe about 5-7 days ago now.
Right. Okay. I haven't gotten to it yet, so I'm here with the audience, ready to listen.
Naughty Hamish, you call yourself a value investor.
I know. Shame on me. Shame on me.
Shame on you, mate. So Warren Buffett, we know that he writes one of these every year. And finally, we get some news out of Warren Buffett because it's been slim pickings for the last little while. It's kind of, he hasn't really been doing much in his portfolio.
No.
And Charlie Munger passes away and he puts out a 2-line statement. He hasn't done any media interviews. It's kind of like Warren Buffett's just been a bit MIA over the last kind of 6 months or so. But of course, that stopped whenever this was released a few days ago because we did get his shareholder letter. It was a good one, actually, Hamish. You're gonna enjoy reading it. I'm sure we'll go through the major points here. But yes, firstly, the whole first page of the letter is normally Warren Buffett talking about his results versus the S&P 500 and getting stuck in this way. That was, in fact, at the end this time, because the first page was just, it was just a full tribute to Charlie Munger, which was really, really nice. So he spoke about a fair few things. I'm going to summarize the most important point here. He said, quote, "In reality, Charlie was the architect of the present Berkshire, and I acted as the general contractor to carry out the day-by-day construction of his vision. Charlie never sought to take credit for his role as creator, but instead let me take the bows and receive the accolades. In a way, his relationship with me was part older brother, part loving father. Even when he knew he was right, he gave me the reins, and when I blundered, he never, never reminded me of my mistake. In the physical world, great buildings are linked to their architect, while those who had poured the concrete or installed the windows are soon forgotten. Berkshire has become a great company. Though I have long been in charge of the construction crew, Charlie should forever be credited with being the architect."
Mm, so interesting.
I think that's quite nice.
Yeah, in many ways, I mean, in many ways, Munger is a philosopher. Like he's really just, a lot of people think of him or talk about him as like a, just as like a thinker, right? Like he's someone who has these amazing philosophies, not just on investing, but on life and business. So it is interesting to hear Buffett kind of describe it, describe him as the architect, as kind of the visionary of the way that they've done things at Berkshire.
He's got really good mental models. And once you've got those fundamental rational kind of anti-bias models in your head, then you can apply it to lots of different areas. Like, and Charlie always said that he applied that to lots of different areas of his life, including investments. And of course, it paid off very well because there's so much psychology behind being a good investor. So, and we know that, you know, it was Charlie that originally, when he teamed up with Warren, one of the first things he said to Warren is, "Forget about these cigar butt companies. Like, stop doing that. Stop following this Ben Graham approach. You just got to pay a fair price for a great business and hold on to it for a long time." And that totally changed the way Buffett invested. And that's obviously the core fundamental investing principle that Berkshire was built off of, and it came from Charlie. So it's really nice that Buffett kind of took the time to give him that credit. Because I honestly don't think that Charlie gets enough credit for his work at Berkshire. He's always spoken about as Warren Buffett's right-hand man.
Yeah.
He never gets to stand on his own 2 feet in the media.
Yeah.
He's always Warren Buffett's buddy, you know?
Of course. I mean, if you ask anybody outside of finance, just everyday people, most people have heard of Warren Buffett, but most people probably haven't heard of Charlie Munger, which is mind-blowing for people who are like us, who are kind of in the space. Because we understand how much he's contributed to Berkshire and his own, you know, investing success and his contribution to value investing broadly as just a topic.
Yeah, definitely. So I thought that was a really nice one-page tribute. Then he gets Warren then gets into the actual contents of the letter, talking about, you know, his investment strategy, Berkshire Hathaway itself. He spoke about quite a bit. So I wanted to start off firstly with just what Warren Buffett is talking about when it comes to his investment strategy and what he looks to do and is doing right now. It's nothing that we haven't heard before, but it's good to go over. He says, quote, "He's always looking for businesses that enjoy good economics that are fundamental and enduring, and they also hope that these favored businesses are run by able and trustworthy managers." So immediately covers off two of the four key pillars of his approach. The first one is finding a moat, and the second one is finding really good management.
Yeah.
He says, quote, "This combination of the two necessities I've described for acquiring businesses has for long been our goal in purchases. And for a while, we had an abundance of candidates to evaluate. If I missed one, and I missed plenty, another always came along. But then this is where it gets really interesting. And I was quite interested to see him write this kind of passage. He says, quote, "Those days are long behind us. Size did us in, though increased competition for purchases was also a factor."
Mm.
He says, quote, "There remain only a handful of companies in this country capable of truly moving the needle at Berkshire, and they have been endlessly picked over by us and others. Some we can value, some we can't. And if we can, they have to be attractively priced," so bringing in that fourth key pillar of the valuation into the approach. "Outside the US, there are essentially no candidates that are meaningful options for capital deployment at Berkshire. All in all," get this, Hamish, "all in all, we have no possibility of eye-popping performance."
Like how often do you see a CEO of any company be that honest about the future prospects of the business? It's super refreshing. It's super rare. Because yeah, I mean, he's just laying out the reality of Berkshire's situation and the change in financial markets since he began. Berkshire is massive. There's only so many businesses that they could invest in that are big enough to, as he said, move the needle. And certainly the efficiency of financial markets has changed a lot since they began, especially with things like the internet and the availability of information now. Publicly available information is so widespread.
Yeah, you can think about it as liquidity. The liquidity of the market has risen. Anyone can just quickly jump in and jump out, and mispricings don't last as long. They still do come up from time to time, and he talks about this in a minute. But yeah, you're exactly right, Hamish. I looked up some stats because I'm making a video on it. He said, Berkshire is the seventh largest company in the S&P 500, right? Has a market cap of $868 billion. Their stock portfolio alone is $350 billion, and they've got $167 billion of cash on the sidelines. So it's exactly what you're talking about. There's only so many companies that you can invest in that will move the needle. And invest in, remember, Buffett likes to be less than a 10% shareholder. So big enough that you can make a substantial multi-billion, even 10-plus billion-dollar investment, and then still end up as less than a 10% shareholder. Yeah. So, I mean, immediately, you need a business that's got a market cap of over 100 billion, and there's not that many businesses out there. I actually looked it up. There's only, I think, 90 or 92, roughly around there, depending on market caps at the current time. There's only 90-ish companies in the S&P 500 that have a market cap over $100 billion. And as you know, as Buffett said during that, you know, he's combed over these businesses hundreds of times, as hundreds of others have as well. And, you know, finding those opportunities in those companies specifically is very hard.
Yeah. So, I mean, it makes sense. The bigger the company is, the more eyeballs there's going to be on that company. It's just the reality of financial markets. The bigger it gets, the more success a company has, the more people are going to be paying attention and coming up with an idea of what they think the company is worth. And more people participating just means that the price is more likely to be either closer to its value or even exceeding its value as people are kind of putting a higher value on the brand of that company and the endurance that company's had for, you know, multiple decades in that industry. So it just becomes very, very difficult to find anything at that size compared to when, you know, if you're managing a couple million dollars or $100,000 or $10,000, pretty much the world's your oyster. You can have anything, right? You can invest in any company because you're only buying a few shares. Even companies that there might be literally no analysts looking at. So it's a completely different world.
Yeah. However, there are still opportunities that arise, Hamish, as you say, even for the big dogs like Warren Buffett. And he actually spoke about this a little bit more in the letter as well. So he says, occasionally markets and or the economy will cause stocks and bonds of some large and fundamentally good businesses to be strikingly mispriced. Indeed, markets can and will unpredictably seize up or even vanish as they did for 4 months in 1914 and for a few days in 2021, 1914. I think that's referencing back when he first started investing. He made an early reference. If you believe that American investors are now more stable than in the past, think back to September 2008. Speed of communication and the wonders of technology facilitate instant worldwide paralysis, and we have come a long way since smoke signals. Such instant panics won't happen often, but they will happen. So a little bit of a reminder that, yes, you know, generally speaking, Berkshire is such a big behemoth, they can't really do much. That's not to say that there won't be opportunities in the market. He basically saying there will always be some opportunities. We just have to stay patient for them.
Yeah, it's such an important and it's kind of a funny line, but it is very true that participants aren't any more emotionally stable than they have been in the past. Humans will always, as long as humans are making decisions in financial markets, there will always be swings of optimism and pessimism. And he's right. I mean, yeah, the internet provides, you know, probably more efficiency in that there's more publicly available information, more people bidding prices closer to their what their true value should be. But it also means that panic and emotional driven news and speculation moves quick, and you can really see stocks be affected by an overwhelming shift in sentiment through you know, you have like news outlets all talking about a company's, you know, poor earnings. You have YouTubers talking about it. It's all over Twitter. You get this real flurry of negativity or optimism, and you still see these big swings. In fact, we might even be seeing bigger swings in from pessimism to optimism than we've seen in the past. So those opportunities, yeah, certainly still exist and probably will always exist.
Yeah. It says, though the stock market is massively larger than it was in our early years, today's active participants are neither more emotionally stable nor better taught than when I was in school. For whatever reasons, markets now exhibit far more casino-like behavior than they did when I was young. The casino now resides in many homes and tempts the occupants daily.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's sad, but it's true. I mean, it's great, I guess, that the markets are more accessible than ever before, but accessibility to financial markets is only a positive if you've got the investing temperament that you need to not make rash decisions. I think that's what he's commenting on there.
Yeah.
There will always be opportunities, Hamish, because human psychology just does not change.
Nope.
All right, what else can we talk about? Oh, yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I've been yarning on this so much. I think both of us really have been yarning on this so much over the last 12 months that it was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of nice to see Buffett say this in his shareholder letter, because I was like, yes, finally, from the horse's mouth, he said it. And then that basically is, I kind of first was my mind was opened up to this idea by Monish Pabrai with his talk called Circling the Wagons, which actually gave at Berkshire Hathaway at the Berkshire meeting this time-ish last year, where he was talking about all of Berkshire Hathaway really just comes down to 10 to 12 great investment decisions that Buffett just never sold. He made the investment decision, he held the stock, and to this day, he still holds it. And he's made hundreds and hundreds of investment decisions, right? And so many of them yield just mediocre or negative returns. But just by holding these 10 to 12 stocks, these 10 to 12 good ones for the long term, that's created the company that Berkshire is today, the amazing behemoth, like the company that's, you know, that allows Buffett to say that he's made 20% returns every year since 1965. So,
yeah.
He spoke about that principle of just finding the good ones and holding the good ones as his real investment strategy. And he used two examples. He used American Express and Coca-Cola. This is a long quote, but it's a really good one. So I'm going to read you the whole thing. So stick with me here. He says, American Express began operations in 1850 and Coca-Cola was launched in Atlanta in an Atlanta drugstore in 1886. Berkshire is not big on newcomers. Both companies tried expanding into unrelated areas over the years and both found little success in these attempts. In the past, but definitely not now, both these companies were even mismanaged. But each was hugely successful in its base business, reshaped here and there as conditions called for. And crucially, their products traveled. Both Coke and Amex became recognizable names worldwide, as did their core products. And the consumption of liquids and the need for unquestioned financial trust are timeless essentials in our world. During 2023, we did not buy or sell a share of either Amex or Coke, extending our own Rip Van Winkle slumber that has now lasted well over two decades. Both companies again rewarded our inaction last year by increasing their earnings and dividends. Indeed, our share of Amex earnings in 2023 considerably exceeded the $1.3 billion cost of our long ago purchase. Both Amex and Coke will almost certainly increase their dividends in 2024, about 16% in the case of Amex, and we will most certainly leave our holdings untouched throughout the year. Could I create a better worldwide business than these to enjoy? As Bertie will tell you, no way. The lesson from Coke and Amex: when you find a truly wonderful business, stick with it. Patience pays, and one wonderful business can offset the many mediocre decisions that are inevitable.
Yeah,
so
it's a fantastic quote.
It's a good one. That last line really sums it up, doesn't it? But it's true. I mean, Amex and Coke, they bought it so long ago. And now, of course, the anecdote that people always say is like, now they earn an annual dividend from Coke that's like larger than their original investment.
Yeah.
Something close to it.
It's very close. Yeah. I think the total investment in Coke was about $1 billion. That he made over a number of years through the late 80s and then a couple, I think it ended in 1991. And I believe today they pay him a dividend in the range of $700 to $800 million a year. which is a 70 to an 80% dividend yield on cost, which is just absolutely astounding. So regardless of what the stock value actually does, obviously, I think the stock's also up maybe close to 20 times in value since then as well. So he's made 20 times on his money, which isn't in of itself isn't an astounding return given, you know, well, I mean, it is. It is an astounding return, but over the length of time, I don't know what the compounded rate is, but it's nothing, you know, it's not even close. It's not even above the Berkshire's average. But with the dividends that have been paid along the way and the astounding yields now, it's, it does pay to hold on to those great businesses that just produce a ton of cash every year. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear him talk about that.
Yep. Thoughts on the general strategy of just holding on to the few key winners? I mean, personally, I'm glad that this has come up for me now, because now that I look back even on my own portfolio, I realize that that's also what's happened in my own portfolio.
Yeah.
Most of my investing success has just literally been down to two or three investments that I've made. Even though I'm no God, I make plenty of bad ones, but... Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And the way to think about it, I think, is, you know, if you're invested in a good business that ends up having these amazing investment opportunities over time, you make one investment decision, and then it's like the company itself is doing all of the future investment decisions just within the business. Like the profits are coming in, and the management team is deciding where to deploy it. And if it's an incredible business, there'll be lots of opportunity for internal investments. So, which is exactly what you want. You can make one decision and then you just hold that business. And rather than having to then go and invest the money somewhere else and continually make good decisions, you've just got this engine that continually makes decisions for you, basically. It does make sense. And it's certainly been true for my portfolio as well. It's been a couple of businesses that have driven all of the gains.
It's definitely the way to go. I'm pretty sold on that one. Okay, last two things I just wanted to very quickly cover. I spoke about two investments in detail, Occidental Petroleum and the Japanese trading houses. He didn't go into huge specifics. He said at year-end, Berkshire owned 27.8% of Occidental Petroleum's common shares and also owned warrants that for more than 5 years give us the option to materially increase our ownership at a fixed price. Though we very much like our ownership as well as the option, Berkshire has no interest in purchasing or managing Occidental. So I don't think they're going to do some sort of big takeover. He didn't really talk about the business of Occidental so much, more just generally about the US oil industry, saying not so long ago the US was woefully dependent on foreign oil and carbon capture had no meaningful constituency. Indeed, in 1975, US production was 8 million barrels of oil equivalent per day, a level far short of the country's needs. But he's very excited that since that time, America's really created its own big oil industry, he says. And then, hallelujah, shale economics became feasible in 2011 and our energy dependency ended. Now US production is more than 13 million barrels of oil equivalent per day and OPEC no longer has the upper hand. Occidental itself has annual US oil production that each year comes close to matching the entire inventory of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Our country would be very, very nervous today if domestic production had remained at 5 million barrels of oil equivalent per day and it found itself hugely dependent on non-US sources. At that level, the SPR would have been emptied within months if foreign oil became unavailable. So less about Occidental specifically, more just about he likes backing the US oil industry in general.
Interesting.
Any comments on that, or should we move on to the Japanese trading houses?
Not really, except that, an economic pain point for a lot of countries is being dependent on foreign oil. So it's interesting to hear him talk about that. I was just looking at India, actually, and... whenever they're a massive importer of oil. So when there's been oil spikes, supply shocks in the past, they've been very exposed to those. So that's my comment on that.
Yeah, nice. And then just quickly on the Japanese trading houses, says Berkshire continues to hold its passive and long-term interest in five very large Japanese companies, each which operates in a highly diversified manner, somewhat similar to the way Berkshire itself is run. Berkshire has financed most of its Japanese position with proceeds from 1.3 trillion yen of bonds. This debt has been very well received in Japan, and I believe Berkshire has more yen-denominated debt outstanding than any other American company. The weakened yen has produced a year-end gain for Berkshire of 1.9 billion, a sum that, pursuant to GAAP rules, has periodically been recognized in income over the 2020 to 2023 period. Since we began our Japanese purchases, each of the five has reduced its number of outstanding shares at attractive prices. Meanwhile, the managements of all five companies have been far less aggressive about their own compensation than is typical in the United States. Note as well that each of the five is applying only about one-third of its earnings to dividends. The large sums the five retain are used both to build their many businesses and, to a lesser degree, repurchase shares. Like Berkshire, the five companies are reluctant to issue shares. Mm. So I think that's basically Warren just, yeah, we're in this for the long term. We did our little trickery with the yen-denominated bonds. We made a good investment. They're doing the right things. We like the people. Buy back a few shares. And I think they've made a hell of a lot of money on this investment already, and they haven't even held it for that long. So
yeah,
they're doing pretty well. But there's a bit of an update.
Yep.
But that is all I have from Warren Buffett's shareholder letter. There was a little bit more in there, but I will direct you to the letter itself if you guys want to check it out. So it's a good read. It's a good read.
Fantastic. Yeah, awesome.
All right, Hamish, over to you.
All right, let's talk about something way more important than value investing.
Let's
talk about Bitcoin.
Woo! Where the real money is made.
Exactly. What's Buffett's return been recently? I don't think it's been 57% year to date.
I don't think so. Warren Buffett.
No, but Bitcoin has been absolutely ripping, and it reached an all-time high. It actually reached over 100,000 Australian dollars this week. So. Whew. I thought we better talk about what's going on with Bitcoin because I'm sure a lot of people have been watching it. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have owned Bitcoin. I'm sure there's a lot of people who have absolutely no idea why this is happening. So I thought we could kind of dive into some of the reasons why.
Let's do it.
So for context, I'll use kind of Australian dollars just throughout this, just for simplicity. But I guess I probably should have used US dollars, but it did pass 100,000 Australian dollars this week, which I thought was more interesting than saying it passed 69,000 US dollars.
It's a bigger number.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cleaner number. It is now, it's passed its previous all-time high, which was 87,000 Australian dollars, which was set in November of 2021. It's finally back above 2021 levels, today it's at about 102,000 Australian dollars. It's up 202% in the past year, so it's had an incredible past year, and it's up 57% year to date, as I just said, which is
Take me back 12 months, Hamish.
Yeah, I mean, if you've held some Bitcoin, you've done extremely well. So it's not too often an asset does 200% in a year. One that says as big as Bitcoin is.
It is pretty remarkable if you just open up. I mean, obviously we know it's a speculative asset, but it is pretty. I mean, how many assets? I'm just having a quick look here, right? How many assets go up like 400%, then crater 40%, then go up another 90%, then crater 71%. And then go up 300%. If you're invested, I mean, here's how I'll put it. If I had my entire net worth in Bitcoin, I'd be bloody nervous because it is the most volatile asset that I have ever seen. But it makes sense why it's volatile. It's because you can't say what it's worth. It's worth what's the next person is willing to pay for it. So if the next person is willing to pay a lot for it, it's worth a lot. If the next person is not willing to pay very much, then it's not worth very much.
Yeah, I'm trying to see what's the market cap of. So it's. I'm trying to see what the market cap of all Bitcoin is at the moment.
It would be a lot. Let's see, Bitcoin market cap. Live market cap. How many? Oh my gosh! How many zeros? Million, billion, 1.3 trillion.
1.3 trillion. Yeah. So for something like that to be going, up 200%, down 70% is crazy. Yeah, like imagine if Apple was, you know, doing that, or Google stock or something was acting like that. That would just be insane.
Yeah, no, it would be insane. You're right. That would be absolutely bonkers. Nobody would stand for that. That's crazy. Yeah, Bitcoin, it's normal. It's fine. No worries.
Yeah, but there's actually a fairly simple and there's a fairly simple economic, microeconomic explanation for why it's like this. And it's really interesting if for people maybe who haven't, you know, looked too much into Bitcoin and how it works and how coins are mined and created. So really it's a very fascinating supply and demand case study. If you're interested in that kind of thing, there's some things happening on the demand side and some things happening on the supply side, and the combination of those gives you what we've seen, these kind of massive volatile swings and certainly the increase, you know, 200% increase over the last year. So let's start with the demand side. So demand, of course, for Bitcoin has been a massive driver of why it's been increasing so much. Demand has been absolutely surging, particularly since around January, when we got the launch of a number of US Bitcoin ETFs. So I can't exactly – can you remember exactly when they were launched? I believe it was in – it was either mid-February or mid-January maybe.
Yeah, it was around about that time. It wasn't very long ago.
Yeah, so the last couple of months in particular has basically opened the floodgates for people being able to very easily access Bitcoin and be able to kind of invest in Bitcoin. BlackRock's Bitcoin ETF has now reached $10 billion in assets as of this week, which is an astounding figure. It's actually the fastest ETF to ever reach $10 billion. So it's the fastest for any ETF ever. And the 10 Bitcoin ETFs that currently exist in the US have a combined value of $50 billion. Which is an astounding amount of money, right? Because what did you just say the value of all Bitcoin was? It was like $1.2 trillion.
1.3, yeah.
Yeah, so for ETFs, just in the space of a few weeks to already be worth $50 billion just shows you how much money is flowing into the space. You know, money flowing into these ETFs, and then companies that own the ETFs like or manage the ETFs like BlackRock then, of course, go and buy the actual asset, which drives the price up. Weekly inflows this week actually exceeded into the ETFs, exceeded $2 billion. So the rate of money flowing into these ETFs is incredible. And it shows, you know, there's a lot of people piling in who want a piece of the action. A lot of people who maybe, you know, maybe some of them are speculating, maybe some of them believe in Bitcoin, but didn't, you know, want to buy it directly before. But certainly, certainly demand has been a big part of this, this story.
Yeah, crazy. There's some wild stats. Yeah, you're right. Because this, I just looked it up. The SEC approved the 11 spot Bitcoin ETFs. I'm looking at a Forbes article dated 17th of January. So it's not that long ago for all this to have happened.
Yeah,
crazy.
So that's kind of the demand side. And that's really the simple side of things. The supply side is also extremely interesting. So unlike other commodities, supply for Bitcoin is completely fixed. It's completely fixed. So there's a hard limit of 21 million Bitcoins in total that can possibly exist. Currently, 90% of those, for about 19.6 million, have already been created or mined. Essentially, new coins are created by computers solving complex equations. So people can set up these algorithms and they can do these increasingly complex computations. And currently, about 900 Bitcoins can be mined per day in total. So there is an absolute max, there is a fixed amount of Bitcoin that can be mined basically every single day. And the rate at which Bitcoin can be mined will drop over time. And the last coin will be mined around 2140 is kind of the estimate, the year 2140.
Right.
Which is completely different to a lot of other commodities. So if I just take another commodity like gold, for example, if demand spikes for gold and the price of gold goes up, in the short term, yes, the supply of gold is pretty fixed. You know, if there's just a sudden increase in demand for gold, there isn't going to be a sudden change in supply. It's pretty fixed. The amount that's being mined today is pretty much the amount that's going to be mined tomorrow and the day after that. But over time, over the long run, gold miners will see the higher prices and they can begin new mining projects. They can try and find, they can do more discovery and try and find new mines where they can find more supply. Bitcoin miners can't increase their mining efforts if even as the price increases. It's completely fixed. And the rate of mining actually halves every few years. They call it the halving, and there's actually one coming up. So it's a really fascinating situation where you have it's got some commodity like properties, but in other ways it's a very, very unique asset. Of the 19.6 million Bitcoin that and this is kind of the other fascinating part of it, of the 19.6 million Bitcoin that currently exist, most of it hasn't moved in a very long time. In fact, 80% of the coins haven't been traded in over 6 months. So the vast majority of the coins out there are just not moving. They're just in storage, not being touched.
Interesting.
And there's probably a couple of things, you know, playing a role in this. Some of it, of course, would just be long-term holders, whales in the market that just have a huge amount of Bitcoin and are just happily sitting on it. But there's also a lot of people who have just lost their passwords to their wallets and the coins are just permanently lost, which is a really interesting aspect of Bitcoin, because people can have these kind of offline wallets where they just have a series of words, which is the key. And if you lose that, it's just, you're done. Like you can't get it back. You can't go to your bank and say, oh, I forgot my password, or, you know, I forgot my PIN, but here's my identification. I own this wallet. Or I own this bank account. If you lose your wallet, you lose the coins and no one can ever trade them. They're basically frozen forever.
Gone.
And it's actually estimated about 20% of all Bitcoin is permanently lost to people who lost their wallets.
Oh.
Which, again, is a crazy stat. So not only is the market fixed, you've also got a large part. Not only is the supply fixed, you've also got this huge portion of the market of the coins that will never be traded again.
Wow.
So you've actually got kind of downward pressure also on supply over time as people inevitably lose their wallets.
That's really interesting. Yeah, because you're right. Over time, it's not going to trend. More people are going to remember their passwords.
Exactly. You're not suddenly going to find trend the other way. We've heard some crazy stories, right, of people who had 100,000 Bitcoin on a hard drive from 2013, and they've lost it, and they've been digging through the landfill to try and find it. And a lot of Bitcoin is just in that state. And, we're not going to get that anymore. There's not going to be a new person who buys 100,000 Bitcoin and then loses it. That's something that is really only possible when it was like a dollar a Bitcoin, right? Or something like that, or 1 cent a Bitcoin. But it is an interesting aspect to it, right? Is that
definitely
you can just lose it, and it's permanent. There's nothing you can do about it.
Crazy.
So
I didn't really think about that, but that is absolutely wild.
it's a fascinating kind of asset to watch, because at the moment you've got this enormous demand, I kind of wrote down here where is it going in the future. Obviously, absolutely nobody I think has any idea where this is going to go in the future. It's just fascinating to watch it, either if you're a participant or whether you're just watching from the sideline, but. It's going to be the supply is fixed, so it's really a question of what's demand going to do, right? Is the demand that we're seeing right now a reflection of increasing widespread adoption, and it's going to be this store of value? It's going to become the new gold. It's going to be used in transactions. Yada yada yada. Is this widespread adoption, or is it largely a speculative frenzy? Right? Is it largely people just trying to make money on it going up? That's really the question when it comes to, what's Bitcoin going to do? And the ETFs now existing that were created a few weeks ago is a very interesting spanner that's thrown into it, because for now, it means that it's very easy for people to acquire more Bitcoin, driving the price up. It also probably means that it's very easy for people to pull out of the market. We may end up seeing, you know, maybe I was going to say more volatility in Bitcoin, but I don't think you can even use that term because, I mean, the last time it dropped 70%. So
more volatility. Yeah.
Continued
volatility. I mean, that's the thing. Like, so many people you see online comment that they know where Bitcoin is going. And I'm saying this on both sides. The bulls say, oh, I know that it's going up. And then the bears say, it's worthless. I know that it's going down. But the reality is that nobody knows. Even with a stock, you can't predict what's going to happen in the short term. But over the long term, you definitely can, because you know that things are going to more or less move with the movement of the business over time. But with Bitcoin, you just got no idea. It's literally what the next schmuck is willing to pay for it. And if they're willing to pay more, good investment. Well done. You've sold it for a higher price. If they're not willing to pay more, too bad, so sad. That's the reality of it. That's just what it is. So yeah, where it will go in the future, it's a good question, but no one knows the answer.
Yeah, but it is fascinating to watch.
It's fascinating for me to see that people not keeping their biases in check. Yeah. Like, they're so convinced. They're so convinced they know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You don't.
Yeah.
You don't. I have
no idea. Yeah.
You have no clue. Yeah. It's wild. It's certainly an interesting example in human psychology. The old Bitcoin, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That is a very good point.
Yeah. All right, Hamish, is that all we've got, or you had a little bit more?
No, that's it.
Okay, I want to quickly get through Novo Nordisk because there's not all that much going. This is actually quite a long episode. It's like the Young Investors podcast of last year. We're back to 1 hour episodes.
Yeah.
This one will be very quick. I just wanted to mention it because we've spoken about Novo Nordisk in the past. Remember, they're the makers of Ozempic and Wegovy. Ozempic started as a type 2 diabetes medication and until people started losing weight when they took it. So Ozempic and Wegovy are those big weight loss drugs that are taking over the internet. And it says here, Novo Nordisk shares climbed 8% on Thursday, hitting a fresh record high after the Danish pharmaceutical giant reported positive early trial data for a new experimental weight loss drug. So the company told an investor meeting that the phase one trial of its highly anticipated obesity drug, Amycretin, showed a 13.1% weight loss in participants after 12 weeks. Whoa. According to Reuters. But this reading eclipses the 6% loss recorded after a 12-week trial for the company's wildly popular obesity drug, Wegovy, which is the one that Elon Musk himself is taking.
Wow.
So that's phase one, but it's pretty, pretty promising, right? 13.1% weight loss versus 6% weight loss. They also note that a phase two trial will begin in the second half of this year with results expected in early 2026, the company said. So, yeah, shares of Novo Nordisk, Europe's largest company by market cap, that's wild that they're the largest company in Europe now, have gained more than 27% since the turn of the year as the pharmaceuticals giant continues to reap the benefits of rampant demand for its flagship Wegovy and Ozempic anti-obesity drugs.
And the pharmaceutical industry is so funny. Like, pivot of this company in like the last, 12, 18 months, 2 years or something like that is just kind of astounding.
I just love it. This company was like a small-time type 2 diabetes. That's what they did. They made medication for type 2 diabetes, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of diabetics in the world, but there's a lot more fat people. And then just, can you imagine the moment when they got the trial data, because they were testing Ozempic for, you know, effectiveness in around insulin, right, for type 2 diabetes. And can you imagine when the doctor's like, yeah, I mean, it does the trick for type 2 diabetes, but we found this really interesting thing. A lot of these patients are losing weight. Imagine the CEO. Yeah, imagine the CEO just being like, wait, what did you say? What did you say?
Ching.
You said that they're losing. $. Yeah. It's just wild.
Crazy.
But yeah, if you look at their stock chart, it's a bit of a hockey stick, that's for sure. But yeah, it's wild.
Insane.
Wild. They've done very, very well. They are certainly cashing in on this weight loss drug trend. But that's all I had to say for Novo Nordisk. Mm.
Well done, Denmark.
Yeah, go Denmark. Yeah. You know, in Denmark, they publish two sets of data now. They publish economic data with and without Novo Nordisk.
Wait, how funny is that? Actually do that?
Yeah, they actually do. Yeah, yeah.
That's insane.
It's so funny.
And the rest of the economy is in the toilet.
Yeah. Well, like, I can't remember the stat. There's like most, if not all, of like Denmark's economic growth over the past little while has been thanks to Novo Nordisk. It's one company. It's pretty
ridiculous.
Funny.
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, over to you.
Let's
Hamish's fraud story of the week.
We got the fraud segment of the week. I'll have to try and make an effort to find more of these, because whenever I do come across them, they're always so funny, because they're always so different, and they always have their own unique just ridiculousness inside of them. So this one,
I think you also just tell the stories well. Like, I don't know, delivery is definitely something as well. You always crack me up with these stories. I think, I don't know, just like you reading it, just being like, how bonkers is this? Yeah. I don't know. It always cracks me up.
I just find it ridiculous. But this one's called Pillow Talk Securities Fraud. This week, Tyler Loudon pled guilty to insider trading after engaging in what's called Pillow Talk Securities Fraud.
Oh.
So what happened? Tyler's wife was an executive at BP, of course, England's massive oil and gas giant. I'm going to refer to the executive as his wife in this, just because her name was redacted from all the articles. So that's why I'm not using her name. So I'm just going to say his wife. That's what all of the his articles wife. Kind of said. But so Tyler is, of course, the person who engaged in insider trading, and his wife, since COVID, had been spending a lot of time working remotely, working from home. One day Tyler was, I don't know, maybe he was in the kitchen, he was cleaning the bench or something, and he heard his wife discussing a very large acquisition. So she's probably, you know, working away on the laptop, and I don't know what he's doing. He's folding laundry or something, and his ears prick up. And
what's that?
Yeah, so he overheard his wife talking about a $1.3 billion acquisition of convenience stores and restaurant properties from the company Travel Centers of America. So this was going to be a cash deal to buy about 280 stores that basically these kind of petrol station stores on the side of a highway kind of thing, which would essentially be a massive deal for BP expanding its fuel and electric vehicle charging stations, these petrol stations and these electric vehicles charging stations. Yeah. So his ears pricked up, and he thought, hang on a second. This isn't public information yet.
I can make some money.
Maybe I could do something here. So of course the deal at the time was not public information. And the kicker is that the bid price from BP that he overheard from his wife was an 84% premium to the current stock price of whatever the company's name was, Travel Centers of America. So essentially, when the deal was eventually announced, it was probably going to make the stock go up almost 100%, which, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, public information.
That's a big premium.
Yeah, it's one thing to know something that hasn't, you know, become public yet. It's another thing to know something that's going to make the stock move almost 100%, which is crazy.
For context, I think the average premium for mergers and acquisitions, the average premium is about 30%. So they have to pay up around about 30% to take full control. So 84% is a big premium.
Yeah.
Wowee.
Yep. So,
if he could buy into the company that was going to get taken over, he could make an 84%.
He could. Wow. But that would be illegal. That would be a crime.
Shh. No one has to know. Hamish. Yep. So, Nobody has to know.
So Tyler, he put the laundry down. He ran to his, he ran to the bedroom, pulled out his Robinhood account. No, I don't. And we don't know how he did this, but he eventually bought 46,000 shares of Travel Center stock, a total value of $2.5 million. So this wasn't...
Wow, he sunk $2.5 million.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So, you know, this isn't some small, you know, this isn't some small, like, side, you know, investment that he's made. Yeah. He's put a lot of money into the company. Of course, the deal was then publicly announced and the stock rose about 70%, making Tyler $1.75 million.
Wow.
So, nice tidy profit.
That's the thing. You know, sometimes I think about this, not that I'd ever do it, but like insider trading, it would be so easy to get away with, but people just blow it because they get too greedy. Yeah. Like, no, for the record.
ASIC just joined the podcast.
Yeah, ASIC just like,
what did you say?
Hello, bro. Yeah, just say that again. No, I'm just saying that like, because we read so many of these stories, right?
Yeah.
And like there was a case where two guys were working together at the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and they were trading futures and with inside information on what Australian inflation was going to be when before it was announced. But like all these people get too greedy. They just make these massive bets because they do want to cash it. They want to make like, you know, $2 million. But it's so obvious. Yeah, like,
it's ridiculous.
It's so, like this, like the executive's husband just made $2 million by betting on the company that the executive works for. That company, the BP was going to say, so obvious.
And she's obviously on the team that's working around the acquisition because she's discussing
talking it. About the acquisition. So not only does she talking about it on the phone.
She doesn't just work at the company. She's managing the deal.
Yeah. it's like you just need to be a bit more. Like I just watched Better Call Saul. Mm. You need to be a little bit more like Mike from Better Call Saul.
Be a bit savvy,
right?
Okay?
You need to be more suave. You need to be more under the radar. Mm. Don't be like Walter White. You need to be like Saul. What is his name? Mike Ehrmantraut.
Yeah.
Anyway,
well, he actually kind of got away with it for a little while.
Did he really?
So, you know, week went by, another week went by, nothing had happened. About a month after the deal, he actually confessed to his wife that he'd eavesdropped on her, and committed securities fraud. He basically told her that he wanted to make enough money so she didn't have to work long hours anymore. Which, I mean, if you're dropping $2.5 million on insider trading and your wife's a BP exec, I don't know if money's a big problem, but maybe I'm crazy.
True.
So the SEC didn't even know about this, but he confessed to his wife. She moved out of the house and filed for divorce and then reported her husband to her boss and the SEC. So he got caught basically because he told his wife, and fair enough, his wife was like, you just committed a massive crime, then divorced him and dobbed him in, which is hilarious.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny.
So Tyler was then, of course, charged with insider trading from the SEC. He also pled guilty to criminal charges from the U.S. Attorney's offices in U.S. Attorney's Office in Texas. He faces up to 5 years in prison and $250,000 in fines, which is pretty crazy. And Tyler's wife, the BP exec, despite reporting her own husband for insider trading as soon as she claimed to have found out, she was eventually fired despite internal and external investigations finding that there was no evidence that she knowingly leaked the acquisition.
Brutal.
Which is, I guess you'll never know, right? I mean, this is the investigation found that he eavesdropped and did it.
Yeah.
It could very well be the case that they conspired on it. That's why it's kind of called pillow talk, securities fraud. It's a husband and a wife. One of them has private information who's just telling the other person and then they trade on it. So you never really know, of course. No one's no one's in their house. No one knows if she participated in it. But
you don't quite know the full story.
But no one won in this story. She got fired. He's facing prison, and that's it. Well, BP won. They got their acquisition.
So. And a long story short, that's my way of telling you all that BP has acquired, yeah, so, what was it called? Travelers, yeah, Centres.
So the moral of the story is, if you commit insider trading, don't tell your wife.
just do it, just, and keep it on the,
yeah,
down.
Exactly, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. What a great takeaway to end the podcast, yep, everybody. If you're going to commit insider trading, don't tell your wife.
Yeah, that's the lesson.
All right. With that said, everybody, we are going to sign out of here. Thank you very much, Hamish. That was good fun. Yeah. I feel energized despite being horrifically sick at the moment. I feel good after that. Thanks very much, guys, for tuning in. As always, we appreciate you joining us each and every week for this podcast. Definitely leave us a review or a rating if you want to. Share us with your friends. We're trying to grow the podcast a lot more this year, so we really appreciate any of that stuff. That is very much appreciated. But guys, with that said, thanks very much for watching. We'll see you guys next time.